Welcome to The Founder's Mind. This is your host, Adam Mutchler. On today's episode, I have Alan Gannett, the founder and CEO of TrackMaven, a marketing analytics company based in DC. In addition to running TrackMaven, Alan is also the author of The Creative Curve, where he interviewed some of the best creative minds in the world. In our conversation, you'll learn how Alan went from an aspiring print media mogul in the fourth grade to the founder and CEO he is today. As a serial entrepreneur, Alan has a lot of incredible insights and wisdom. We dig into the importance of developing your team, how creativity doesn't strike like lightning, and beyond. Stay dialed in throughout the episode to pick up some of the best advice he's received and what he wished he had known at the beginning. Well, I have Alan here from TrackMaven on The Founder's Mind. Welcome, Alan.
Hey, man. I'm excited.
You are the CEO and co-founder of TrackMaven. You are releasing a book that you have written and talked to some people that I love. And you have an endorsement from one of my favorite authors, Daniel Pink.
Oh, love Daniel.
Which is amazing. You have this video series on LinkedIn. You're doing a lot. Can you share a little bit about, can you tell us in your own words kind of what you're up to, who you are?
Okay, sure. So my job is I run a company called TrackMaven. We're right now recording in the TrackMaven office, and we're a marketing analytics company that's used by a lot of huge consumer brands. So think about the MBAs of the world, Saks Fifth Avenues, you know, GE's used us, like Microsoft uses us, like a lot of big brands that people use day to day. And our whole thing is that marketers are facing a challenge where they're expected all of a sudden to not just tell amazing stories and be creative and build brands, but also to somehow be data scientists. And so rather than be something you're not, we are your outsourced left brain. And then I also do a couple other goofy things on the internet. So I run this very silly LinkedIn video series, which is fun, where I do these 90-second interviews with CEOs. I started that last July. It's gotten over a million views. It's been really just a fun little adventure.
I think Kobe Bryant was on there at one point.
Oh my God, everyone. I literally know nothing about sports ball, and everyone's always like, Alan, he interviewed Kobe Bryant. I'm like, it was an 11-second interview. He answered my question with three words. It doesn't count. But we still posted it. And then I have a book coming out June 12th. So depending on when this airs, either soon or recently.
Yeah.
And the book is all about creative genius. Now anyone can learn to achieve moments of creative genius. And it really came from, I'm a kid from New Jersey, and I get frustrated. And I got very frustrated with how many people would tell me shit like, oh, like I'm not that creative. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, you know, I wasn't born with those things. Like, I'm not talented. I'm like, well, that's not actually how creativity works. Mm-hmm. Like, there's actually, creativity is a skill. It's nurturable. And I realized that this thing, which I knew and had like done a bunch of reading about, is actually something that we don't really, in our sort of culture, is not how we actually internalize creativity. We think creativity is this thing where it's just like this magical, organic, roiling thing. And like, we're lucky if it struck us when we were in the womb, and otherwise, you know, we're screwed.
Yeah.
And so the book is two things. The first half of the book is meant to discredit this notion, this inspiration theory of creativity. And the second half of the book is I interviewed about 25 living creative geniuses, so billionaires like David Rubenstein, startup people like Alexis Ohanian, chefs like Jose Andres, Tony Award winners, Oscar winners, Grammy winners. And from those interviews, I also have four prescriptions of things you can actually do to enhance your creativity. So it's definitely in the like pop science airport books category of books.
Nice.
With a lot more science and stories and I think information than a typical book in the genre.
I love it. I'm excited about
Thanks.
It.
Great.
Honestly, I'm pretty amped. I Great. Ordered it love when it. You were talking about it in the beginning.
Amazing. Adam, what a guy. So charming.
Aziz Ansari went and signed his books in airports.
Really?
If you see yours in an airport, will you sign it?
Anything for you. If it amuses you, I'll do it.
You graduated from GW, mm-hmm. and then it looks like you went right into running companies and founding companies and businesses. So what got you started in founding businesses?
I think it goes back to like being a only child of heavily divorced parents, in that they were divorced when I was like two. Mm. And so I think I always was just like highly independent. I just didn't have, there wasn't like, both my parents worked all the time. Yeah. So there just wasn't a lot of people around.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to solve problems myself and be resourceful. Mm-hmm. And so I've been sort of entrepreneurial since I was very little. And, you know, I started my first quasi-business when I was probably in fourth grade. I started like a alternative school newspaper.
All right.
That was print, which wasn't very smart. And then I started in my first business.
So are you judging yourself for starting a print newspaper when you were in fourth grade?
Yeah.
Like what would have been the preferred medium?
Digital. Hello.
In fourth grade?
Hello.
Okay.
In sixth grade, I transferred it over to digital because I realized the error of my ways.
Yeah.
And then
what was digital in sixth grade?
GeoCities.
Yeah, I was going to say GeoCities. It was great. Okay.
My HTML skills were off the chains. It was, our school colors were blue and white, and so the background was blue, the text was white, highly readable.
Perfect.
And then, amazing.
And very accessible.
And then in high school, I started my first real business, and that people actually gave me money.
Nice.
To do stuff. And I started, a print music magazine. This time it was just, I'd keep doubling down on print.
Yeah.
And it cost me $3,000 to print the first issue, and I sold only $800 in ads, which I think is like actually for first issue wasn't terrible, but the math just did not work well.
Yeah.
And so that didn't work either. And so that also I turned into digital after the first issue. And then in college, so that was sort of my like entrepreneurial project.
Yeah, it was there.
Yeah, and then in college, I started a company that actually had employees. It was a company called Splash Networks, and we did Facebook performance marketing. Back when Facebook performance marketing was like just, there wasn't like, you know, Tai Lopez Facebook videos about it. Like it was a thing that like people didn't really know how to do. And so we were super early. We did it primarily in education arena. So we did a lot of education marketing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like crazy. Like you could literally get clicks for like 5 cents. And I hated it. It was just insufferable to spend all day sort of thinking about like, how do you get people to like click a button?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that company in college, sold it right after I graduated for a very small amount of money. But that's sort of what got me, that was my first sort of, that's where I made, I think, a lot of really dumb mistakes.
Yeah.
So that when I started TrackMaven, I just made dumb mistakes.
Not yeah.
Really dumb mistakes.
Like pseudo dumb.
Yeah. Like, no, still dumb. Definitely dumb mistakes. Okay. But not like really dumb mistakes.
Not catastrophic. Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
And
hopefully.
It sounds like...
But still lots of dumb mistakes.
I mean, I think we all make mistakes.
Oh, all the time.
I mean, you wrote a book on creativity.
I was late for our meeting. That's a mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
The fucking worst.
I'm surprised I even stayed.
I know. He didn't stay. He left. I chased him down the hallway.
What gets you energized? What gets you energized about
the work you're doing? I like seeing people... I like seeing... So internally and externally, I like seeing people develop. So mm-hmm. internally, I really like the sort of coach role and the ability to like make people better and mm-hmm. like see them just like literally prosper, mm-hmm. right? Like that's really cool, seeing someone get promoted, seeing someone like become a better version of themselves. Like I like when we promote people and all of a sudden people are making a lot more money. Like it's cool to see people, because of a company you built, be able to like have upward mobility. Like that's actually really stimulating. And then externally, I really like the role of sort of a teacher. Like I speak at a lot of marketing conferences. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of one-on-one meetings with customers. I sort of act as a data coach, marketing coach, and that to me is really fulfilling, just the ability to, even though it seems very corporate, the ability to like help someone be better at their job and their career. Like it's cool to me when I see our customers like get promoted, right? Or they move companies and they get the CMO title. Like that's very thrilling. It's like, oh, like we like played a small role in this. That for me is very fun. I like the sort of professorial/coach type relationships.
Yeah. There's something very enriching about helping others achieve what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah,
it's fun.
I mean, I'm biased because I am a coach, so like, I definitely enjoy it. It's what draws me to it. There's also an element of people inviting you into their journey and, you know, bringing you on as a partner in whatever capacity that in a lot of ways for me is kind of humbling. You know, you get to be in some very interesting conversations and part of some very interesting thought processes.
Yeah, and as someone who's very curious, it's just fun because I think generally people are the most interesting. And so being a CEO, one of the things that sort of I think maybe undervalued is you are literally a professional extrovert.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly meeting people. You're constantly, like I probably have in a day 8 to 10 scheduled meetings and probably 10 to 20 unscheduled conversations between phone calls, interactions, like whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are interested in people, it's a very cool job just be able to like consume lots of information about people and like learn stuff.
Yeah. I think that was really interesting. You said professional extrovert because it also, you know, made me think there are a lot of people that are CEOs or leaders that are introverts, you know, and that there is this extroversion in the role of CEO.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you spend a lot of time with people.
Yeah.
Dealing with people, talking to people, hiring people, yeah, all the stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
You're doing a lot. You've had a lot of businesses, whether they were projects, you know, first business, second business.
I think this is my first real business. Like, this one I've been doing for almost 6 years. The other ones, I haven't done anything for more than a year. Uh-huh. So this is the one that I think of as, like, company one, if that makes sense. So when I'm, like, old, this will be the first company. I'm just young, so we look at projects and we pretend they're
You're not gonna say, you know, like, the fourth grade print paper was your first?
Oh, no, that was some real mogul shit.
What's a challenge, if you have a favorite challenge or something that you're working through right now, that has kind of got your brain running?
I mean, I think the perpetual challenge when you're running a business is people. I mean, before you start a company, you sort of read, like, Inc. or Entrepreneur, and you see, like, the tropes about, like, it's all about culture and people, and you're like, that's, like, cliche.
Yeah.
Then you start a company, you're like, oh, wait, it's literally, like, and I think it's so hard for people who, like, haven't run a company before to sort of internalize this, but, like, literally, if you were CEO and you could do one thing, if you just hired a great team, you would actually, that's probably the most effective use of your time, because, like, everything else sort of takes care of itself. Mm-hmm. Now, it's impossible to hire a team that's, like, 100% perfect, right? So, yeah. Like, inherently, you can't just let it run by itself. But in a world where you could just hire a team that was all 100% perfect, like, the rest of running the company would basically take care of itself. So that is literally the most important thing. And that's always a challenge, just because people are complex. And
yeah. I think about with a lot of founders and with a lot of companies, your greatest competitive advantage is, you know, how dedicated is your team? How are you treating your people? And you can overcome a lot of ground, you know, or a lot of, you know,
100%.
If you've got the right people. What's one of the more impactful pieces of advice you've received as a founder?
I mean, okay, this is maybe, I'll give you a meta answer to your question.
Go for it.
I think I found that early on, I was very good at surrounding myself with people who could give me good advice. I was very bad at listening to it. Mm. And it's been interesting to see over the 5.5 years I've been doing this, how frequently that advice is true. And so I've gotten much better about, like, listening to other people's advice. And so my sort of meta advice would be that, like, you really need to listen to advice. I think it's easy to get advice. I think listening to it, especially when you're an entrepreneur, we're all very stubborn. We're yeah. like, well, that's not what I think. And we just look for advice as validation of our pre-existing thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so I've gotten much better at being like, okay, this person I'm asking is very smart. That's why I'm asking them. I actually need to be open-minded to it. And that for me is, like, an intentional thing.
Yeah.
Because there's so many stupid things I've done that I would have avoided if I listened to someone earlier. There's so many times I've had a board member who's like, hey, that executive is not working. And mm-hmm. I'm like, no, they're fine.
Yeah.
6 months later, I'm like, I'm starting to have problems. They're like, they're not working. I'm like, they're fine. I'll coach them. 6 months later, I'm like, I gotta let this person go.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the cliche example when it comes to personnel. Mm-hmm. I think we're very good as people of having our own biases, confirmation bias, you know, loss aversion, all these things. And I think being mindful of them is really important, because then in a moment, and now I do this better, you can sort of start thinking about, like, okay, this is the feeling or the emotion I'm having. What are the possible reasons I'm having this outside of the logical, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of times if you have, like, a brand new employee and they're doing terribly, you try and tell yourself it's not that bad, because you don't want, you're just like, I just made this decision. I don't want to look stupid. There's all this stuff. And so you have to be aware of your own cognitive biases. Otherwise you make decisions that are not good.
What's one thing that you wish you knew in the beginning that you know now?
I think I wish I knew more about just, like, how competitive markets get, and how some of the competitive stuff I think was probably foreseeable if I had more experience. Mm-hmm. And you know, that just causes a lot of stress. And I think, you know, if I had sort of been there, done that before, I probably would have foreseen that, and probably would have done things differently in terms of how much to invest in product R&D and product innovation early on. So I think generally one piece of advice for people is just to, like, even when you have product market fit and product differentiation, you have to be really paranoid about, like, the fact that, like, you have it right now. Mm-hmm. And especially in technology markets, like, we've seen shifts every 6 months. Who our competitors are shifts, how hard it is to sell shifts. Like, we had a big competitor of ours get acquired, and that was great for us. And all of a sudden, like, all that pressure from that one competitor just went away. Because typically when companies get acquired, like, it's not good for them. And so that was great. And so, but that was unexpected and unforeseeable. And so that was a good example, but lots of examples of the other thing happened where someone launches a product that enters your market that you weren't expecting. And all of a sudden you're like, ah, so.
I'm sure. And I'm sure that occasionally you have clients asking about said products.
Oh yeah. No. When people ask about competitors, you know, it's great. Love it.
You mentioned the importance of listening to advice, you know, and this is something that you've taken to heart more more recently. Is there a piece of advice that you have for yourself that you may not be following as stringently as you'd like?
Oh my God. Sure. Totally. I think generally, you know, when you look at a subscription business like mine, you know, customers have the ability to opt in and out all the time, mm-hmm. right? And so generally you have to be perfect across every variable, right? And so you have to be, product has to be perfect, service has to be perfect, sales has to be perfect. You can't actually, like you can't run a successful subscription business if sales isn't good. Well, you also can't run a successful subscription business if marketing isn't good, but everything else is great. Like everything has to be perfect. Which is interesting. I think sometimes it's easy to forget that and say, well, right now we're going to focus on this function of the business. We're going to over-rotate on this. And you sort of forget that with subscription businesses, it's sort of like this careful pendulum and it's very easy to get out of whack.
Mm-hmm. Who's a founder that you admire and why?
I admire Ben Horowitz just because his book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, was like probably the best book on entrepreneurship ever. Have you read it?
Yeah.
It's just like the most real to like the actual problems that go on and sort of the dilemmas. And like he has a chapter on like how do you fire your friends, right? Like it's like that's like real problems you have to deal with when you're starting a company because you tend to hire people who are your friends. And so that's, I think he just has the most sort of realistic look at being a CEO. I think a lot of the other looks are very romanticized.
That's a really interesting point and something that comes up in a lot of conversations is like the sex appeal of being a founder or an entrepreneur and how it's just like glosses over all of what you just said, like the very real.
Yeah. Thing. Here's this. I mean, being an entrepreneur is literally flying United Economy to like second tier NFL cities to meet with customers and constantly have a fire drill that you can't tell anyone about because, you know, it's either confidential or it's a personnel related issue, so you can't tell anyone. So like it is very not romantic. It is like very, very, very not. If you want to get into it for the romance, like don't do it.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's something that people are getting better at talking about and showing, you know, but there's definitely this like the end game. And I'm sure in the book that you wrote and it's coming out next month about creativity, you know, we see the end result and we assume that it was easy, or we see the end result and we assume it's the same with Olympic athletes. You know, you see someone sprint and break a world record, like Katie Ledecky just broke her world record recently, and you don't see the literally thousands of hours every 4 years in between that 100%. Goes into it.
And we're very bad in our culture of, I mean, one of the common things I talk about in the book is, you know, Mozart, we think of as this kind of classic child genius, but like, here's the real story of Mozart. You ready? The real story of Mozart is when he was 3, he had essentially a helicopter dad who told him, little Mozart, I love you, but, which you should never tell a child, I love you, but you need to become the world's greatest musician. And he was like, what? And he was like, I'm going to hire you, the best music teachers in all of Europe, and you're going to practice 3 hours every single day. And little Mozart was like, okay, dad, I love you. And so little Mozart practiced 3 hours every single day, 7 days a week, from the age of 3. And he wrote his first true piece of original music, not when he was 4, as it says in Amadeus, but when he was 17. And there's two problems with it. One, it's not very good. And two, this is after 14 years of practicing 3 hours every day with the best music teachers in all of Europe under the conditional love of a helicopter dad. Like, you'd be half decent too. And so the issue we have in our culture is that we see the end results and we tend to like, both want to assume and have been told just because of how they're representing the media, you know, hashtag fake news, we want to believe that these are just like, for some people it's so easy,
yeah,
right? Like J.K. Rowling, there's a story of her being on the train and being hit with the idea for Harry Potter. No. She literally took 5 years to write the first book.
Yeah.
5 years! And she was on welfare. Like it was a whole thing. And so, and I actually think, I talk about this in the book, I think part of the issue I think part of the issue is we actually don't want to believe that it's possible.
Yeah.
Because I think that means to us that, oh, well, then I'm choosing not to.
Yeah.
I'm avoiding the hard work.
Yeah.
I think there's something easier to thinking, well, for some people, it's so easy. And so if it's not easy for me, I'm not going to try.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, it's not easy for anybody.
Yeah.
And oftentimes when we think it's easy, just because they started when they were like three, like Tiger Woods started when he was a little kid. So like the hard part, he pushed through that way before you even thinking about golf.
Yeah.
He pushed through that when his father was forcing him to push through that, right? And as adults, we don't have anyone else necessarily to push us through things unless we construct that construct. So we then use this as an excuse. We use this sort of inspiration theory of creativity as a reason not to try.
No, I agree. I mean, one of the things that I think about, you know, I look at any individual success or any individual accomplishment, and I think to myself that it's an example of what the human potential is and that we all have that potential. It's, are we as committed or are we as consistent to that, whatever that sort of level of achievement is, whether it's financial, whether it's athletic, whether it's creative.
There's all these studies that basically show that IQ and creativity are not related. So there's two sort of really good studies that make this point. One is, there's a study that literally compares IQ tests to creative potential tests. What they find is that over an IQ of 104, which is basically average, everyone has the same creative potential. There's no correlation. That's like billions and billions of people. That's not like a dozen people like we think about in Western culture. That's billions of people. That's one. The other study that's really fascinating is Lewis Terman is the guy who Americanized the IQ test. And so the Stanford Binet IQ test is, he was at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took the Binet IQ test, which was French. He Americanized it. And part of his rationale for the IQ test was actually in the early 1900s, people thought that geniuses were like weird and bad because there was all this, in the late 1800s, there was all this literature about like the evil genius, like Frankenstein-esque stuff. And so that was actually the popular notion, was that if you were a genius, you were like this like maladjusted, you were so good at one thing that you were terrible at everything else. And so we had this sort of cute notion of like, well, the sort of the average man was the best because they were good, they were okay at everything, they were well adjusted.
Yeah.
And so Lewis Terman wanted to disprove this, so he Americanized the IQ test, and then he took thousands of children in California, tested them for IQ, and proceeded to take the ones who had a genius level IQ, which was like, I think, around 2000, and he started sending them surveys every 5 years for the rest of their lives. Even after they died, his proteges kept sending the surveys to see, okay, if you follow these young geniuses from the time they were kids, how their lives develop.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, fun fact, he called these kids his termites.
Terrible.
Terrible branding. The worst. Yeah, the worst.
You weren't there.
Not good. Anyway, so these termites, here was the interesting thing. So these are kids who had genius level IQs. You would think, okay, if you follow them from birth, you'll see all this amazing achievement, blah, 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 blah. The reality was, not a single one of these kids became a household name. There wasn't a Nobel Prize, none of this. So, they were normal on things like depression, alcoholism, suicide, divorce, all that stuff. They were also just normal on success. In fact, the only two kids he tested, they later went on to win Nobel Prizes. Neither of them had genius level IQs. So, like, the notion we have that, you know, to be a sort of creative genius, you have to be an IQ genius, is actually really silly. I mean, IQ actually measures a very narrow set of cognitive skills. There's actually all this stuff also, like, your IQ changes too, depending on how you nurture it. So, like, our Western notion of creativity is just kind of a joke. It's this, you know, it's sort of a historical game of telephone. I mean, Mozart, for example, there's this story that he would think of music in his head. He would compose not in front of a piano. He would, you know, write down first drafts and no edits. This came from a letter that was published in 1815 that was from Mozart describing his composition process. The issue, the letter, literally a forgery. Like, literally a forgery. Literally fake news.
The OG fake news.
The OG fake news. A music journalist who was, like, a big fan of Mozart and wanted to sell copies of his magazine literally just made up this letter. So, like, we just have this sort of silly notion of creativity in our culture that's just, like, completely wrong.
Well, there's, you know, you were just in listening to you talk about the kids and the termites and that study. Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, came to mind, where it's just like perseverance, grit, showing up, and this idea of being consistent and kind of not letting go.
Mm.
You accomplish a lot. And not only do you accomplish a lot, you're probably going to achieve that vision if you just don't let go and you keep at it and you keep putting in that time.
I mean, I like one way to think about it, I think for younger people, is think about when you first get a new video game. Like, you're terrible at it the first 5 times, and by the 50th time, you're great at it. Take that as a little micro example of your entire life. So, you know, for some reason, things like video games were, like, okay with, like, putting in that initial work to get better at it, typically because the video games are sort of designed to make that easier with initial rewards. In real life, you don't get those initial rewards that a video game designer can pop in to keep you motivated. But, like, it's the same idea. Like, we're actually very good at getting better at stuff. There's this concept of something called neuroplasticity, which is this idea that our brain generates a few thousand new brain cells every single day. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is that these brain cells will go and attach to the parts of your brain that are most active.
Yeah.
So, for example, there's these studies that look at cab drivers. And they find the more years that someone's a cab driver, the bigger their part of their brain, which is focused on visual, spatial, and navigational skills, gets. Because literally that part of the brain is more active. It's like a muscle.
Oh, yeah.
And so as these new brain cells develop, they go and attach to that part. And so they literally become structurally better at it.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes sense. I mean, I get in cabs sometimes, and when they're driving and they're like,
what's going on?
Zooming super close to cars. I'm nervous, but they know what they're doing, hopefully. Thank you for having me at Track Maven at your new offices. What's a good way for people to find you, follow you? You've got this book. You've got a company.
The book comes out June 12th. Everywhere books are sold. You can go to thecreativecurve.com. There's a book trailer. My really cute dog's in it. For me, go to alan.xyz, social media links, blog, newsletter, all that stuff. And Track Maven, just Google us. We're everywhere.
Yeah, Alan is definitely everywhere. And you've got the coveted at Alan in some of the platforms, which is awesome. So it's been really good having you. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Founder's Mind. I hope you picked up a tidbit or two you can take into your own life. Check back this week for a mini episode covering a tangent on education that Alan and I got into. On the next full episode of The Founder's Mind, I'll have Janice Omedeki, the founder and CEO of The Mentor Method. In that episode, we dig into how letting a chip on your shoulder can fuel your focus. To make sure you don't miss any awesome insights, nuggets of wisdom, and tangents from the guests of The Founder's Mind, be sure to subscribe on iTunes and follow along on social at The Founder's Mind. To learn more about past and future guests and listen to the other episodes, you can visit thefoundersmind.com. I look forward to sharing future episodes with you all, and don't forget, sharing is caring and greatly appreciated. Until next time, take care.